I was asked to talk about my experiences of peacemaking, and perhaps with reference to Africa. And I said, actually, I would rather set the scene of why Christians should be involved in peacemaking. My background is, I was born in southern Rhodesia, which is now Zimbabwe, and I left during the reign of Ian Smith, and then, seems to be working.
Okay.
Yeah, and I left during the days of Ian Smith, and unfortunately spent too much time at university. I read history first, and then theology at King's here in London, and then law at Oxford, and then went to the bar here in London, and then an LLM in canon law at Cardiff. So I'm a barrister by profession, but my experience of peace work is that I did about 12 years as legal advisor to the Democratic Republic of Lambeth, London Borough of Lambeth. It was the only local authority I knew that had a foreign policy. So after that, I was then headhunted to work for International Alert, which is a UK-based NGO that works in peace conflict resolution, post-conflict peace building, and etc. etc. With that organization, I traveled all over the world, and my main work was with the Sierra Leone conflict. I facilitated the Sierra Leone peace talks. People might want to talk about that. Bringing the rebels from the bush, and then bringing the government of Sierra Leone from Freetown, and meeting in Abidjan, Cote d'Ivoire. I first went there just to be there for 6 weeks, and on and off ended up being 2 years. I traveled all over Africa during that period, including being held at gunpoint for 1 hour in Togo. It was quite an experience. When I left International Alert, I worked there for the British Quakers. I was the International Relations Secretary for Quaker Peace and Service, managing their office here in London and their Quaker United Nations office in Geneva. And again, with the Quakers, traveled all over the world on behalf of the Quakers. Then, of course, when the Iraqi war broke out, it became very difficult to be traveling around the world with a British passport saying, I've come to talk peace. So I was very disillusioned and stepped a bit from the peacemaking process and went back to Oxford to be the registrar at Christ Church. Then after some time, I thought, well, perhaps things are changing. I should go back to peacemaking. Little did I know that we're going to get into more difficulties. So I took the position of director of the Fellowship of Reconciliation, England. And those who know the Fellowship of Reconciliation was founded in 1914 to try and prevent or stop the First World War from happening. And still going, and all its 100 years, it has had 6 Nobel Peace Prize winners. And now we spent the whole of last year celebrating 100 years of non-violence, peacemaking, and reconciliation. So I thought I would just talk generally about why Christians should be involved in peacemaking. And I'll use some examples, mainly from Africa and from my work. And of course, peacemaking, Christian peacemaking in Africa is not different and shouldn't be different from Christian peacemaking anywhere else in the world. And Africa hasn't got there, it has no monopoly on conflict and violence. Violent conflicts are not only confined to Africa. While there is no doubt that Africa has contained many violent countries and places, the same can be said of other regions of the world. Of course, you know, in Europe, with the breakup of the Soviet Union, that unleashed untold violent conflict in Eastern Europe. Latin America has been on fire for a long time. Asia, going back to the India-Pakistan conflict, Afghanistan, name it, a lot of it, and West Papua, East Timor, Cambodia, and of course now we have got the Middle East. What can one say about that? You'll hear more about that. And of course, humanity entered the 21st century full of hope following the collapse of the Cold War. It, however, soon became clear that we had moved from Cold War into very hot peace, a peace from hell, as someone once described it. Similarly, as we entered the 2011, again we were full of hope, people were full of hope with the Arab Spring, which has turned into, I call it a very cold Arab winter, or a very, very hot Arab summer. But we are here to discuss how Christians should deal with conflict. And in this world of ours today, what should Christians do to bear witness to the God of peace, the God who created humanity in his own image? For Christians, I'm sure the starting point should be the Sermon on the Mount, which is just the gathering of Christ's ethical teachings. As we know, I'm sure I'm talking to people who already know this, the church and all Christians were pacifists until AD 313. Christians would not take part in war or play any role in war until that year. Well, until 312, and the militarization of Christianity came with Constantine in AD 312. You all know the story of Constantine when he was waiting at the Malvern Bridge during the invasion of Italy to capture Rome from Emperor Maxentius. While he was praying, he was not a Christian, by the way, and while he was praying, he had a vision, and in the vision he saw a cross bearing the inscriptions, "Conquer by this." Thus came about the combination of the cross and the sword. There is evidence, however, throughout Christian history, from the apostolic age to the present, that there have always been Christians who strongly believed in pacifism and non-violence. Erasmus, for instance, writing, Erasmus 1640 to 1535, wrote, they who defend war must defend the dispositions which lead to war, and those dispositions are absolutely forbidden by the gospel. Since the time that Jesus Christ said, "Put up thy sword into its sheath," Christians ought not to go to war. Today, there are at least 18 Christian churches that still practice pacifism. The well-known ones, of course, being the historic peace churches, i.e. the Quakers, the Mennonites, and the Brethrens. And then, of course, there are organizations such as the Fellowship of Reconciliation, which I have just mentioned. And this Christian non-violence pacifism has been attractive to other big figures who are not Christians. For instance, Mahatma Gandhi said, "The message of Jesus, as I understand it, is contained in the Sermon of the Mount. It is that sermon which has endeared Jesus to me." This was Gandhi, who's not a Christian. He goes on to say, "The message to my mind has suffered distortion in the West. Much of what passes as Christianity today is the negation of the Sermon on the Mount." And one more quote from Gandhi. "The only people on earth who do not see Christ and his teaching as non-violent are Christians. I like your Christ. I do not like your Christians. Your Christians are so unlike your Christ." And from a very unlikely source, Karl Marx, very unlikely source, said, does not your practical life continually give the lie to your theory? Do you turn your right cheek to someone who slaps you on the left? Or do you rather file suit and battery? But the gospel forbids it." And too often the world has seen Christians witness that bears little resemblance to the Christ they claim to follow. But Christians are called to be peacemakers. Hence the Sermon on the Mount, "Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called children of God." Christians are called to be reconcilers. As we read in 2 Corinthians, "Therefore, if anyone is in Christ, he is a new creation. The old is gone, the new has come. All this is from God, who reconciled us to himself through Christ and gave us the ministry of reconciliation." And that's what the Fellowship of Reconciliation took as their starting point. African churches have been struggling with conflict and how, as Christians, they should be involved or not involved. They are now looking at a theology of harmony, compassion, forgiveness, and reconciliation, which is sort of a post-liberation theology. And how do we deal with conflict today as Christians? It is not all conflict that Christians should oppose. Conflict is not necessarily a bad thing. Conflict is not evil by its nature. This is because sometimes the absence of conflict may mask gross injustice, discrimination, exploitation, and oppression. In such a situation, avoiding conflict and maintaining the status quo exacerbates these conditions of injustice and unfairness. What, for instance, would have happened had there never been conflict in South Africa, in Southern Rhodesia, and in all, as you know, in all the colonial countries that rose up in conflict in order to fight for independence, equality, and justice? What would have happened, for instance, in America if the black Americans had not risen in civil disobedience to fight for racial equality and justice? So in such situations, conflict is necessary and indeed welcome. In his letter from Birmingham jail, Martin Luther King responded when he was criticized by white clergy and white Christians about what he was doing. He responded by writing and saying, "Actually, we who engage in nonviolent direct action are not the creators of tension. We merely bring to the surface the hidden tension that is already alive. We bring it out in the open where it can be seen and dealt with, like a boil that can never be cured so long as it is covered up, but must be opened with all its ugliness to the natural medicines of air and light. Injustice must be exposed with all the tension its exposure creates to the light of human conscience and the air of national opinion before it can be cured. So there is room for conflict, but it is violent conflict that Christians must and should oppose and seek to be involved in. It's violent conflict is what it is. But even then, as Christians, we should seek to resolve such conflict through non-violent action, through forgiveness, through compassion, and through reconciliation. Of course, non-violence and pacifism can sometimes be seen as a negative and somehow quite misleading terms. It can be understood to mean a passive refusal to engage in violent activity. But the way it is used in progressive and positive peacemaking, conflict resolution and reconciliation, non-violence refers to actions taken to engage in conflict and violent struggle without doing violence to persons or, in most cases, to property. Non-violence has been defined by Gene Sharp as a technique used to control, combat, and destroy the opponent's power by non-violent means of wielding power. What they call in Latin America, femenza permanente, meaning relentless persistence. That is to avoid the negative or passive connotations of non-violence. And as I just said, the African churches are trying to go back to the roots in the Bible, trying to turn back to the Bible and find some answers in the situation they find themselves in, and ask themselves, is there evidence that non-violent pacifism are biblical? Has it got roots in the Bible? And of course, the answer to that is yes. And as I've said, the Sermon on the Mount is the starting point. But if you look at the Sermon on the Mount, ask yourself, was Jesus really politically aware? You can ask how he would have reacted to today's wars and today's conflicts. What would he be saying about the situation in the Middle East, which we shall hear about, you know, in ISIS, Afghanistan, all the conflicts in Africa, conflicts as all over the world? Christians disagree on what Jesus would say. Indeed, in such debates, there have been great attempts, often with robust theological sophistication, to try and sanitize Jesus and make him safe so that the status quo can be maintained and not to be scandalized by Jesus' teachings and standards of justice, peace, righteousness that he sets out. But taken at the face value, the teaching of the Sermon on the Mount can appear to be an impractical ideal at best and dangerously naive at worst. Loving your enemy does not seem to make a practical sense in a world of violent dictators. For instance, telling Jews in the concentration camps, Ugandans under Idi Amin, black people in apartheid South Africa, to turn the other cheek could be seen as begging belief and another fetter into their suffering and the bondage. Praying for your persecutors does not remove landmines, chemical weapons, bombs, nor does it stop suicide bombers. So what was Jesus talking about? I mean, was he naive? Was it due to inexperience of real violence or the world? Or was it sheer ignorance of reality? Not so. I think Jesus lived in a very violent and oppressive empire, the Roman Empire. Roman military might dictated every aspect of life and ruthlessly was enforced, and it forced the Pax Romana, a peace on Roman terms and under Roman law. Those who opposed that power of Rome could be dealt with ruthlessly, you know, with crucifixion, as we know. So he was not living in a make-believe land. And Christians in Africa, like religious people everywhere, have at different times taken different stances and shown different attitudes to conflict, from supporting conflict to actively opposing conflict. This is nothing new, and that was the situation during Jesus' time. When powerless people are subjected to violence and oppression, there are five ways in which they can respond to that violence, and that is as demonstrated in the Holy Land during the Roman occupation and Jesus' time. African Christians have done the same. And the five ways you respond to conflict and violent conflict, and what Christians and churches have done that. The first one is to counter violence with violence, including self-defense, guerrilla warfare, insurgency, revolution, and terrorism. This is how the Zealots reacted to the Roman Empire in Jesus' time. And for the Palestinian Jews, the Zealots were seen as freedom fighters, widely seen by the Romans as terrorists. Such was the zealous determination that when Titus captured Jerusalem and destroyed the temple in 70 AD, about 1,000 of them committed suicide at Masada rather than surrender to the Romans. Many African Christians did support the struggle for independence, aligning themselves with the nationalistic freedom movements and the guerrilla warfare. That was the case in Kenya, the Mau Mau, the case in Zimbabwe, you know, ZAPU and ZANU, the case in South Africa, Umkhonto and Sizwe. Christianity in Africa had always played an important role in education and therefore liberation. Let us not forget that the missionaries started schools all over Africa. And almost all the nationalist leaders and people who became president and prime ministers went to mission schools, from Kwame Nkrumah in Ghana, Abubakar Tafawa Baleo of Nigeria, Julius Nyerere of Tanzania, Kenyatta of Kenya, Mandela, South Africa, Methodist, Kama of Botswana, Joshua Nkomo Ntabaneng Sithole and Mugabe of Zimbabwe. Robert Mugabe is a staunch Catholic. So they went through Christian schools, and that's what influenced their zeal for equality and justice and liberation. So that was the first reaction of violence by violence, confronting violence by violence. The second response is that of withdrawal. This can either be a physical or psychological withdrawal from society, the ostrich syndrome. The essence in the New Testament and mystics responded by withdrawing from society. They didn't want to have anything to do with the Roman Empire and society. So they withdrew, went into the desert. And examples of today's withdrawal would be people in our society choosing not to talk anything about politics. Well, don't talk about politics or religion in a pump, but you can talk about music, cinema, and anything else but politics. And there are churches like that today in Africa that have withdrawn. There are the churches called the Zionists in Central Africa. They wear white robes and they don't recognize any boundaries, and they just walk around and they don't have anything to do with politics. Except that some politicians today have seen that they could actually benefit by aligning themselves with those people. Because they have no land, they wander around all over Africa. Politicians like Robert Mugabe has given them the repossessed farms so that they are now comfortable and they vote support for him. They support him. And that was the third withdrawal. The fourth is the religious option. This was the route taken by the Pharisees in Jesus' day. They focused on careful and exact piety. This was fancy and elaborate religiosity that did not engage with the sufferings and the struggles of those around them. It was a disengaged piety, super spirituality and religiosity that had nothing to do whatsoever with the pains of those suffering under the yoke of Rome. Oh, and of course, we know many Christians, churches, and establishments like that today. But the fifth way, which is perhaps what is now engaging many people, Christian peacemakers, is that which was outlined by Jesus. You can call it the Jesus way. I think people used to call it the third way until Tony Blair started using that term as well. So people call it the Jesus way. This is where the Sermon on the Mount comes in. See, Jesus rejected the first four responses I've mentioned. And instead asked his followers to choose a fifth way. That has been described, and in the paper you'll get the references, that has been described as transforming initiatives. In most cases, in most oppressed scenarios, all the initiatives often rest with the oppressor, and the oppressed simply choose how to respond to the violence. Jesus, in the Sermon on the Mount, calls upon his followers, who are perceived as powerless by the world standards, to take the initiative themselves. They are not to respond to the oppressive situation by following a script acceptable and understandable to the dominant power. They are to initiate a new set of events to which the dominant one must respond. The initiatives are transforming because the relationships and the context are jolted out of the expected patterns where victim and victimizer know their roles and act them without much thought of what they are doing or why they are doing it. The transformed relationship and context opens up new possibilities in which repentance, reconciliation, justice, and peace can take place. It is this concept of the transforming initiatives, or Jesus way, at the back of our minds that we can begin to make sense of and understand where Jesus is coming from on the Sermon on the Mount. And of course, then he goes on to give the practical examples of that by talking about, you have heard it was an eye for an eye and tooth for a tooth, but I say that if we have time, we can unravel that. In Africa today, we see a great move by church leaders and ordinary Christians to engage in nonviolent peacemaking, forgiveness, compassion, and reconciliation. There is a move to go back to the Bible, and a belief in the power of love and reconciliation to transform unjust political, economic, and social structures. There are branches of the fellowship, there are branches, for instance, of the Fellowship of Reconciliation all over Africa. Quakers are great in numbers in East Africa. I think East Africa is probably the largest number of Quakers, and second followed by the United States of America. But the Quakers in East Africa are very evangelical, and they do sing hymns. they enjoy singing hymns. And because some Quakers in the United States, my surprise, do carry guns. Because they say, if you are running a shop, if you are a Quaker in the state and you are running a shop, you keep your gun underneath the counter. But that's not all of them. Not all of them. A lot of them still say, no, I would rather talk to the burglar rather than keep a gun. There are various Kairos groups all over Africa, and mainstream churches of all denominations are getting involved in dealing with conflicts. They're engaging with their politicians, they're engaging with diplomats. They're looking for what they call positive peace instead of negative peace. Negative peace is merely the absence of war. Positive peace is not just the absence of war, but it addresses the structure, it seeks to remove the structural violence. It addresses the systemic cause and root causes of conflict, which are injustice, discrimination, poverty, corruption, inequality, denial of human rights, etc., etc. To that end, the church leaders have been involved in facilitating peace talks. When I was in Sierra Leone, for instance, I did work with the Sierra Leone Council of Churches. We all know the involvement of the All African Council of Churches in the conflict in Sudan. The General Secretary Carr did facilitate the peace talks in the conflict in Sudan. But the way they do it in Africa, in the church leaders, they want to see some dignity. They don't take lightly to people coming to do peace talks wearing jeans. So Carr, General Secretary Carr, when he went to these meetings, he was driven in a limousine. And the conflicts in Africa, some of them are they're not religious. Take the example of Sierra Leone, the conflict there was not religious, was not ethnic, it was not tribal. You had members of the same family on different sides, members of the same tribe on different sides. And the rebels, before they went into an engagement, they had prayer. So you had the Christians sitting in one corner praying, and Muslims sitting in one corner praying to go to war. So, and they say, well, we have to engage with politicians at their same level, so they go in suits. So since the church leaders are getting involved in all those work, church leaders are getting in the mediation, they're getting in reconciliation work, and truth commissions. We know all about the truth commission in South Africa and Kenya, Sierra Leone, Uganda, etc. Christian NGOs and grassroots movement are getting more involved in peace, in organizing workshops, dealing with trauma and post-conflict reconciliation. And the Christians in Africa today are involved in organizing seminars, running conferences, running workshop in peacemaking and non-violence. Trauma healing, I've mentioned, they're involved in issues of gender violence, issues of gang violence. They're even involved in engagement with international organizations such as the World Trade Organization, the World Bank, because of the policies the organization develop have great impact on Africa and cause violence. They engage in issues of of biodiversity, they engage in issues of climate change. I'm just coming to the end now. So the church has, as it were, been, I think, converted in Africa. They're being converted. I guess I said they are trying to get back to the biblical roots of peace and dealing with conflict. Desmond Tutu, who has been involved greatly in this initiative, both in South Africa and Côte d'Ivoire, and I quote from what he said in 1993. So, and I quote, "We are helping to make a song and dance about human rights. It is beginning to happen. Consider the role played by the churches of Kenya in the face of a hostile regime, or the witness of the Roman Catholic bishop in Malawi. A similar stand has been taken in Zaire. When an honest broker was needed in Benin to facilitate the transitional process, the political parties looked to the church. This constitutes a new opportunity for the church to regain its integrity and to promote the cause of justice and peace on this continent in a manner that has not been done since the beginning of the African independence movements. The church is not true to itself if it keeps silent when people are exploited and or abused. To violate the rights of people is to violate God, whose image dwells in them. To neglect or abuse people is to neglect or abuse Christ himself. Whatever we do to others, we do to him, i.e. Christ. It is as simple as that. And the gospel of today, the gospel of modern African church, is the old gospel. The gospel of loving your neighbor as yourself, the gospel of peacemaking, and the gospel of being as proclaimed in the Sermon on the Mount.